Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So as of last night, my last check, it looks like in the Cook County State's Attorney's race, there is about a 2,000 vote lead for Eileen Burke with about 3,500 votes to count. So it's possible that Clayton Harris can pull this out still by hook or by crook. He would need, you know, based on those numbers, about 58% of the remaining ballots that have been found to be counted in his favor in order to be victorious. Of course, this development relates to 10,000 ballots that were found in, or that were, put into drop boxes that were discovered by the election officials over the weekend with a sincere apology that they hadn't been included in the original count.
Yeah,
312-642-5600, Turnkey DePro answer line, 646-36DA, Turnkey DePro text line.
Yeah, we got the word that, you know, he apologized. This is Max Bever. He's the director of public information for the Chicago Board of Elections, releasing a statement and adding up the total number of votes by mail ballots the board had received back so far. I mistakenly left out additional ballots that had been received back via USPS the evening of Monday on March 18th, the night before the election.
Yeah, it's all a bit hazy between like these drop boxes versus mail-in ballots that he says should have been included in the original universe of ballots to count that were not and are now. And so we just need to wrap those up and then we'll have a result and nothing to see here and everybody will go on their merry way. Well, it is interesting. I understand that Eileen Burke has retained Dan Webb. I don't know why exactly you do that because he's not really an election attorney, but sure. Okay. Sure. It's, you know, sort of signaling I'm bringing in legal firepower if this goes south on me. Of course there is a hue and cry from her camp about these found ballots. Boy, isn't that ironic. The Irish complaining about found ballots in a Cook County election. You know, how's that for a little bit of a twist?
Well, I'm just mad that I didn't take you up on your first offer for $10,000.
Yeah, well, it's far from over, as I was just saying. I know that we go from, we use fact-free speculation to support fact-free speculation. I understand that's how a lot of Chicago voters do it. It's easier than having to sort of follow logic and evidence. So what we did last week is...
No, my logic, Dan, was that I knew that they were going to find ballots that they needed. That was my logic, because we don't have fair...
That's not logic. That's not logic. That's just, I guess that would be learned experience. But that's not logic. That's just, you know, a shot in the dark based on how Cook County elections are often administered. And I told this year. So
the ballots were found from a drop box in their own building at 69 West Washington. And so, if they need more ballots, would another box of ballots appear?
Well, has that been confirmed?
That's what one of my sources told me. That has not been confirmed from Max, because I've called Max and left several emails and messages like, "What the heck is going on here?" and have not heard back.
Well, getting information from Max, that's also not reliable. So what you actually have to do, which is what we're doing, we'll talk to Brian Tipponi about it at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour, is we're FOIAing and we'll sue if necessary to get a list of all the ballots cast and from this batch in particular from where they came. so you can bump it up against the actual voter rolls, and you can actually call real human beings that are alleged to have vote and find out if they did indeed vote the way that they did. This is how you do it, and this is why you need voter lists made publicly available so they can be cross-checked and you're not relying on Soviet officials who spend most of their time railing about defunding the police like this Max Baver guy.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Let's take a call from Mary Kay in Western Springs. Good morning, Mary.
Hey, you guys, I was an election judge for the first time this past election, and I also pulled a Republican ballot because I am a Republican, and I don't want to be a Democrat on my voting record, but now I kind of wish I had voted for Eileen, even though last week I listened to your analysis saying it's not going to matter much, you know, one over the other. I just think I could take listening to Eileen Burke more than I could listen to that Clayton, keep calling him Clayton Travis. What's his last name again?
Clayton Harris.
Clayton Harris. Okay. So being an election judge, you're supposed to signature match or at least try to signature match. Somebody came in to vote. Clearly it was not a match. Clearly. And this lady said to me, I changed my signature on purpose because I don't want people to forge my signature. And I said, really? Is that what you did?
I called her so other people don't forge my signature. Got it. Yeah.
Exactly, Dan. Exactly, Dan. I'm like, what the hell? So I call the man over who's in charge of the place, and he tells me I'm too far in the system to go back, and I would have to call downtown and this and that. And I'm like, well, don't we just go back and call downtown then? I mean, what do you do? And he's like, you just, this is how it is. He kept telling me, you feel me? You feel me? I'm like, I don't really feel you. I don't even know what you're trying to freaking say to me. I just thought you're supposed to do the best you can. And rather than, what the hell? So the best you can. So this lady's vote is going to count, even though she is clearly not a signature match. It's because it doesn't matter. Anybody walked in and said, I live here. And unless you know for a fact that John Smith doesn't live in 600 Thatcher in River Forest, Illinois, he gets to vote. No matter what, even if now I understand people with Parkinson's and stuff come in and they can't do their signature.
Yeah, we don't need like every possible contingency under the sun. We get it.
As an election judge for the first time, I'm like, that's how it is.
All right. Thanks, Mary Kay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. I mean, I guess let's take a walk back just a few steps in history since both Amy and I were in this place. I mean, in 2006, with the Todd Strozier election against Tony Parrika for Cook County Board President, and I was Parrika's campaign guy, when we stormed the Cook County building, all chaos broke. We were having our, election night festivities at the Intercontinental. And, these Southside wards are not coming in. And from our boots on the ground, as outnumbered as we were, we're like, there's something going on. They won't let us in. They're talking about they're going to just box up the ballots and the tapes and just drive them to, central booking, drive them to the Cook County building. I'm like, well, how do they protect the chain of custody there? Nobody knew, and so on and so forth. So we said, well, this is bull jive. Right. So we just did the entire contingent, and you were there as a reporter, walked from Intercontinental across the bridge to the Cook County building, and chaos ensued. We saw people coming in with cardboard boxes that were not sealed, and it was, the whole thing was a melee. So that's just one of innumerable examples over the years of how Cook County administers elections. So we can't pretend to be surprised that they're just finding new and exciting ways to maladminister elections in the digital age, or with the digital advancements that have occurred between, say, 2006 and 2024, and some of their innovations that, of course, we were treated to during COVID, which is the mass mail out, the drop boxes, and so forth. So that's what's happening. Now, it is It is interesting. This is not a fait accompli that Harris wins, by the way, because, one, I mean, your source notwithstanding, we don't know. It hasn't been confirmed. I don't know with certainty where those ballots came from. So in terms of the wards, because if you look at it, as we did last Thursday, some of the return sort of neighborhood by neighborhood and ward by ward, what you saw generally was a pattern of Eileen Burke overperforming Paul Vallis and Clayton Harris underperforming Brandon Johnson in their respective, you know, areas of strength. And so this was, I was describing that it was pretty likely that Eileen Burke was going to hold on until these magical 10,000 ballots occurred. appeared.
And I'm so glad you guys are on it, but it just, that's his job, is to know where the ballots are and how many need to be counted. And he fell asleep at the wheel for Max Bever.
Well, he doesn't know anything. No, it's not. He doesn't know anything about the administration of elections. You just said he's the PIO. Tony Preckwinkle doesn't know anything about the administration of elections. There are very few people that actually understand the mechanics of elections that have actually worked an election on that side of it. Uh-huh. And I'm not just talking about in war rooms waiting for tapes to be brought in back in the day or counts to be relayed. I'm talking about actually understand where their vulnerabilities in the system are and all of the moving parts of that comprise the infrastructure of election. That guy's just a flack. He doesn't know jack. And neither do most of the people that are talking about this, because they, be outside of being an election judge, how many people have really done the street work? And that was my point too over the weekend. Not just the hypocrisy of the Irish calling foul, because this is just tribal war. That's all this is. This is the gangs of New York in the 20th century. This is the tongs of San Francisco in the 18th century. I mean, the 19th century, the 1800s. That's all this is. So I love how people get so vested in Eileen Burke, but why? What does it matter? There's nobody wearing white hats in this story. There are fixers on both sides that do know how to do it. Public sector unions have people that know how to administer, in quotation marks, elections. And so do, you know, the Irish machine political hacks, like, well, where Brian Hopkins emanated, who's now all of a sudden aghast at Dropboxes, and he's horrified by election irregularities. The guy was John Daly's chief of staff. He's a lackey for the Daly family for the last 30 years. I mean, come on. Get the fish hooks out of your mouth, people.
John and Piatone, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Good morning.
Hi. Referring to the lady that was talking about the signatures, you know, you can change your style of your signatures only so much. There's always, and I've been an election judge for 45 years, there's always certain letters and things that have the same book or inference on the style of that. You can tell. You can tell. I don't care what they do. There are certain letters, certain ways that they do them that doesn't change. So, you know, if you really question it, send them out. If they don't want to go out, call the sheriff, have them removed. End of story.
So, as
we're going through like everything last Thursday, then more as more votes were counted and Burke's lead was shrinking, some of that made sense. By the way, you know, this is not all one category of votes. So some of the last 20 precincts that were counted, which were in majority black wards, South Side wards, Harris then started to overperform his performance in some of his other areas of strength. So that was part of what closed the lead too. So some of it is plausible, and some of it with respect to these 10,000 ballots that were found is much less plausible. So it's complicated. And this is why relying on the pronouncements from the Chicago Board of Elections is total folly, completely unreliable. What you need to do, and what we're in process of doing, we'll talk about at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour, is just get the data. Get the data. The data tells the story. And this is a lesson. The lesson about 10,000 votes, the lesson for November for the rest of the country that matters is not, oh, the 10,000 ballots they found. The lesson is what you need to do to prevent what you see happen in Cook County or Maricopa County or Milwaukee or so many, or Fulton County or so many other jurisdictions.
Right. Why don't we just have one board of elections, and like a Cook County board of elections, and why do we have a Chicago board of elections? Can we just join them together?
It's called the feudalism. You know, this is a feudal model of government. Mm-hmm. What? That they have 50 feudal wards, the feudal king or queen as the mayor. Then you have another layer of feudal aristocracy, and then another layer over that. And then another layer under it. I mean, that's what we have. That's our system. I mean, could we do, this is like, could we, why don't we have voter ID? because of the choices we've made. What do you mean? Again, the solutions to this are very straightforward. The political will is the problem, not a lack of good ideas.
All right, let's go to Frank in Tinley Park. Good morning, Frank.
Fingerprint system. You know how fast those things are? Pour duty inkwell like Saddam Hussein's people, the Iraqis. One vote, one finger.
All right.
The purple ink. Right. Everybody raise your thumb who's voted. Right. Yeah, I mean, look, right. The elections would be more reliable if we went back to an analog system. Now, as we well know, Richard J. Daley, the analog system is hardly fail-safe either if you have the control of the machinery. So technology, a reversion to a pre-digital era, you still have the same fundamental problem that these elections are not trustworthy because the people who operate the machinery are not trustworthy. And there's just no getting around that, is there? Why do we have that? Because the electorate is untrustworthy. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I'd say the historical trend always shows that the mail-in ballots and drop boxes always go to the worst candidate. I think Burke's done, and Crime's Free is going to continue in Chicago. Thanks, guys.
Well, that's going to continue in Chicago regardless, which I don't know how people have lost that narrative. Oh, Clayton Harris wins, it's going to be more of the same. It's going to be more of the same with Eileen Burke, too. Except the only difference is you're going to get shined on, like Chicagoans love to be shined on, with the press release politics of a Rahm Emanuel. So Eileen Burke office, she's not taking on these people. I mean, I'll bet you dollars to donuts. And by the way, if you still want that $10,000 bet on Burke, I'll take it. I'll book that action.
Maybe $1,000?
You want it? Talking big before. No?
You still think that Burke's going to win, even with all these new ballots?
I'll take that action.
Let me consult my accountant.
Yeah, right. with respect to Burke, here's what you're going to get if she is victorious. Mm-hmm. You're going to get press releases about where we prosecuted this retail thief who stole $500 because it's a new day in Chicago. So we're, prosecuting these retail thieves and we're striking a blow for the retail businesses in Chicago. That's what you're going to get. You're going to get press release politics to make you believe that something seismic is happening when it's not.
What about putting repeat gun offenders behind bars? She says she's going to do that and make sure that they stay there. That's that small little glimmer of hope. And then the felony from $300 to $1,000 is the reason why I pulled a Democratic ballot, and I did not want to do that, trust me.
Kim Fox said the same thing. I'm going to put repeat gun offender. Who doesn't say that? Is there a politician that doesn't say we need to put repeat gun violent offenders or repeat gun offenders behind bars? Everyone says that. And everyone's a fiscal conservative. And let's just keep believing everyone's saying what they're going to do and who they really are and pay no attention to what they actually do. Everyone's a fiscal conservative who's going to get repeat violent offenders off the street. We have the worst run state and city and county in the country. They're all functionally insolvent. And we have one of the highest incidents of repeat violent crime. talking about Chicago, of any major metropolitan area. So all these people are so committed to doing these things, and yet here we are. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. My favorite topic, property taxes in Illinois.
Oh, yeah.
We have another installment, ABC7, and their I-team is on the job, finally, after 35, 40, 50 years. So every few months, they profile another sliver of Cook County that's getting their brains beaten in and their houses liquidated. A few months ago, it was Rich Township, like unincorporated Rich Township, Tinley Park area. Now, property taxes in Lyons Township. Reassessment's going on, and you know what happens when you get reassessed. Your property taxes will soon be going up. That's how it works, because we have chosen. We have chosen.
Who's
That's
the
how
we
it should be in? Said. The Illinois electorate is the we.
Right.
We have chosen to have more units of government than any other state. We have chosen to write blank checks to government school systems, regardless of performance. We have chosen to have our homes be collateral for somebody else's guaranteed seven-figure net present value pension. That's what we chose. Some of us, I guess, were willfully blind or blissfully ignorant, pick your description, and didn't realize that consequence will be visited upon poor old them. I know I'm supposed to have empathy for somebody that sees their property be reassessed, property reassessment increased by 650%.
Jeez.
I know we're supposed to feel empathy for that person, and I don't. And maybe you think that makes me a bad person. That's, you're entitled to believe that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Let's hear about the plight of the residents in Lyons Township.
In south suburban Lyons Township, Jamie Flaws, her husband, and many of their neighbors fear the end of their close-knit neighborhood. They're anxious that they may have to move because of property tax assessment spikes. Some face increases of nearly 650%. Residents say those assessment increases don't match the market values of their homes.
We probably won't be able to sell these homes because they're not even close to being worth what the assessment says.
Because of the new assessments, the Flaws property taxes will more than double from $7,000 a year to more than $16,000 a year.
Ooh. It will destroy my kids' futures because all of our investment has been for 36 years in our home and land.
After losing their first appeal, the Flaws hired an independent appraiser who found the market value of their home to be half as much as what the Cook County Assessor's Office declared, $450,000, compared to the assessor's $878,000.
Hey, the good news for Jamie Flaws, your house has retained its affordability.
Yay.
That's how we describe it. My home is still very affordable after owning it for 25 years. That's wonderful. I'm celebrating that I got zero return, actually negative return, on the biggest investment I've made. Do people have empathy for Jamie Flaws? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-360A, turnkey.pro, text line. Is it just me who's going to be the mean one in this story?
That's a big difference, though, Dan. They got it assessed for $450,000, and the county thinks it's $800,000-something. That's a big difference. And how do you fight? Like, they hired this independent, you know, person to find the worth of their house, and what else can you do besides move? And even moving's going to be hard because no one's going to want to take on that tax burden.
I understand all the implications. So, do you have empathy for Jamie Flaws and these Lyons Township residents?
I don't.
Why not?
Well, which I should.
So why not? Why don't you?
Because they're all pea hat wearing men walking around there, and they get what they deserve. They're all a bunch of liberals. They voted for this. They put the politicians in place that supported this, so they have to pay the consequences.
I mean, and maybe some of them aren't liberals. I mean, but they are the walking dead from the neck up, whether they self-identify as left or self-identify as right. Tom Ahern, Rich Township. Yeah, he's probably just going to pack it in.
I'll probably move.
Tom Ahern was shocked when he saw that his land assessment increased 643%, nearly doubling his yearly tax bill from $10,000 to more than $18,000 a year. He says he's left with just one choice.
Sell the house, take my losses, and move on.
Yeah, there you go. There's the program in Illinois. Sell the house, take my losses, and move on. And thank you for your service. You'll get maybe a certificate with a ribbon on it from the local school district or from the county. Won't that be nice? Now listen to this. Jamie
for
Flaws.
Tom.
Wait.
I said I feel bad for Tom. I mean he's. I mean.
I thought you said you just. I thought
he's
you
such
just said
a dope.
Didn't.
Well, I just feel bad for him because he's. You know. Where's he going to move to? It's not better anywhere else in Illinois unless he moves out of state.
Well, that would be the play, yeah.
Right.
That would be the play, wouldn't it? That's what's happening. But listen to Jamie Flaws. This is very much like when they did the Rich Township piece a couple months back, and you have just the most incredible things that are said by people. So you're just telling me about how your property taxes will double, that you won't have anything to pass down to your kids, this largest investment you've made in your life collectively as a family. And listen to what Jamie Flaws says.
It's not that we have an issue with rising taxes. We don't know where they came up with these figures.
It's not that we have an issue with rising taxes. We have no problem with continuing to see our home equity whittled away in a methodical fashion. We're just arguing now about the pace because the reassessment is just way too high. Go ahead and steal it a little bit at a time. Just don't take it all at once, is the plaintiff wail from Jamie Flaws. And I'm supposed to have sympathy for that mentality or empathy for that mentality? That's the mentality. No, of course we have no problem with rising taxes. Why would we? Look at the wonderful government we get for it. Look at the wonderful services. It's not like we live in some cacistratic kleptocracy. It's not like we're getting fleeced from every which direction. It's not like we're paying property taxes for schools that do, at best, a mediocre job at providing the opportunity for kids to earn a quality education. In Cook County, at the county level, boy, that is just a tour de force in good government. Well, all the wonderful, Jamie, tell us about all the wonderful services that Cook County offers that you access, you know, with respect to you pay in, so you get these wonderful, well, tell me about them. And tell me, and if you could, separate them out from the wonderful services you get from your township government. And then if you would, separate those out from the wonderful services you get from your municipal government. Tell us all about it. Tell us all about how, look, it's not about the slow liquidation of my home. It's just, you know, you have to be a little bit more gentle when you pick my pocket. You can't just rip the whole wallet out.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Let's go to Greg in Jefferson Park. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Dan. You know, my next door neighbor, and this is, you know, the county too. Whenever it got done, it's a brick bungalow, 1.5 stories, full basement, right? It's listed, and a picture of the brick bungalow is on the county's assessor's web page. Yeah, it's listed as a single-family frame house with one bathroom on a slab. I mean, it's just astonishing that none of these people, you know, do anything. But, I mean, it's the corruption and it's the way it is. And it's like this lady, we don't mind our taxes going up. Well, this is what happens. You get what you get. Corruption is here. It ain't going anywhere. Guys, have a good one.
Right.
Thanks, Greg.
Right.
Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Couple things. Number one, all you got to do to solve this problem is get in front of a judge that agrees with the one that valued Mar-a-Lago at $18 million only. So you just get a judge to declare your property's worth nothing. And number two, where do these people think the money's coming from to buy the Bears and the White Sox a new stadium?
Exactly. So, right.
Not to mention
to fund all those six-figure salaries and guaranteed seven-figure pensions for all those public sector workers, including elected officials, since we have more of those in the state of Illinois than any other state in the nation. You know, we did this campaign back in the 2018 cycle, focused on this issue because, as I probably relayed before, the theory was,
mm-hmm.
and there was some polling to support it, but it's sort of unreliable. Until you make the actual argument, you can't tell what people are really at because they just give you the responses that they think they should give you. But it's hard to get a full appreciation for what their thinking is or lack of thinking is until you make the more detailed argument. But the theory was people will, you know, try to protect their home value.
Right.
That people care about the largest investment that most of them will make in their lifetimes. And even if it's not the largest investment for some, it's still a significant one and they care about it. So if they properly understood what was happening to their home values, they would revolt against the people that have set up this system where you don't own your home. It's just collateral for somebody else's seven-figure guaranteed pension, as I've said a million times. But we were wrong. No revolt. Nope. And, you know, fast forward and you see what happened? I don't know where they're getting these numbers. Heavens!
It's like she just woke up or something.
I tell you, it's almost like Cook County's not on the up and up, I think. Do you? Hey, there's something going on here. Is there? Really? Tell me about it. Boy, have you heard about what these property taxes? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you live in Lyons Township. You haven't noticed that an entire region of Cook County, a third of Cook County called the Southland, is a demilitarized zone? There are pockets in South Suburban Cook County that look ripped from the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't noticed that, though. It's so far away from Lyons Township or Rich Township. I didn't go over to Rich Township. Nobody, word hasn't gotten out, hasn't spread all the way up to Lyons Township about this yet. I mean, you know, it's just astonishing to listen to these people. And so you just sit back and I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do other than explain it and really direct ridicule in their direction. It probably sounds mean-spirited. It probably sounds like I'm piling on. You have to make an example of people. And you have to make this concrete so people really, so people who are sensible understand this is what you're up against. And by the way, this is something that could have been taken up by an opposition party and really been central to trying to drive a revolt, but an awakening that would precipitate a revolt. But no, it's just too much work to make an argument, to explain things, to take on these entrenched interests who benefit from the property tax system as it is currently structured. You know, the Madigans and the Burks and mm-hmm. Oh, there's Republicans too on this racket. But it's the Lakeview residents. It's the same thing. It's the same mentality as the reaction. I just thought about it this week because I saw that muggings in your fair neighborhood are up 55% year over year.
Yep.
And so I thought, oh, 55% year over year. And I remember way back, all the way back in 2022. The fall of 2022, there was a governor's race, and the Scream ad that I did in that race, which garnered a lot of attention.
Oh, national attention.
Yeah, and then a lot of opprobrium from Jelly Belly, of course, who leaned on the offals in your neighborhood, who leaned on the networks to take the ad down because, oh, I'm voting against Darren Bailey because of that ad you did. Okay. Go ahead. Well, the beatings are continuing in Lakeview, aren't they? How's morale? The beatings are continuing in Rich Township and Alliance Township. How's morale? This is not about, you know, I told you so. Because, I mean, there's no benefit for me for that. This wasn't about being right. This is about people learning to fight for themselves, for God's sakes. And that's just the one thing they won't do in Illinois. They will not stand up for themselves. And that's why the kleptocrats just, you know, run the table.
Let's go to Ron and Carol Streamer on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hi, Ron.
One slaughter after another.
And Amy, Dan, you were mentioning earlier about what are we going to do about the, let's say, election irregularities. I'm curious about what about in the national elections where in the 2020 presidential race, all these states changed the voting rules illegally. I don't hear a word about preventing that from happening again. What's up with that?
No, there's a lot of words and actions in preventing that again. The Georgia has changed. Georgia
okay,
has.
I'm just saying. I'm not hearing any of it. Thanks, Dan.
Well, okay, but it's probably the function of you know. Look, there's. I wouldn't say that the coverage is ubiquitous, even in conservative media. But there's action. There's a lawsuit in Pennsylvania right now with respect to that relates to what the Supreme Court did in that 2020 election to essentially suspend what was statutorily required in terms of election administration. I mean, I have concerns too in places like about places like Maricopa County, but in many of the swing and frankly in Wisconsin, but in many of the swing states, there has been progress. Is there as much progress as you'd like? No, there's still have an advantage. The vote by mail program, is that where it needs to be for Trump and the Republican Party at the national level? No, there's improvements, I think, that have been made, but it's a far cry from what the other side has. So, yeah, I mean, there's a bit of a slowness on the uptake. There's no doubt, but there is action in the states that matter to address some of these failures of 2020. And there's no action in Illinois to address any failures on anything, on any topic from any election. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, as we were talking about a bit earlier. A faux pas occurred at Cook County, well, Chicago Board of Elections specifically, but in the Cook County State's Attorney's race. A few ballots that should have been included weren't included, and now they've been included. And so, you know, we're nearing the end of the counting, and Eileen Burke is nearing the end of her lead in that race, it would appear. But for more on this, somebody who's been doing the numbers crunching, who's been in touch with that identitarian simp, Max Bever, whatever the hell his name is.
Yeah, he's anti-police. Excuse me.
The PIO for the Chicago Board of Elections, the PEW for the Chicago Board of Elections, too. And also in how we should think about this, how we should understand what's happening and what some of the cures are, cures that maybe don't even require a new political ruling class or the deposing of the current political ruling class, things that can just be done through obtaining the data, which can be obtained through FOIA and FOIA lawsuits as necessary. Brian Timpone joins us. He's a newspaper publisher. He's also the founder of VoteRef.com, VoteRef.com. And again, it's just a full disclosure. People listening to the show probably know it because it was such a brouhaha back in the 22 election that Brian and I do newspapers together. So you just factor that in however you want, but in the interest of full disclosure. All right, Brian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy. I'm also a Cook County resident, unlike you. So
yeah, that's true. Right. Well,
and in full disclosure, Brian Timpone was at my first wedding. Okay.
Bridesmaid?
That's right.
All right. Okay. So now that we have all the incestuous relationships disclosed. All right. So Timpone, so what's the deal with the 10,000 ballots that were found? And tell us about what you think is happening and what you know from the data that you have obtained.
Well, if you actually... So when they release the city of Chicago releases its data, and this is where most of the issue is. It's, you know, remember the Cook County suburbs and the city of Chicago count ballots separately, and they do it markedly differently. The guy you're talking about, Jason Bever, you know, left wing activist, you know, defund the police activist, who is the public information officer for the city of Chicago Board of Election commissioners, they're in charge of Chicago. And what happened was they reported the results on election night. And then they said, well, yeah, but we have to wait for the votes. The votes are going to come in by mail. And there's the way that works is if you put your vote in a mailbox, on election day, they give you 10 days in, to let it arrive. You know, Chicago post office system is just as efficient as its government. So 10 days for that to arrive. And then, so they look and see how many people have requested absentee ballots, voted mail-in ballots that they haven't returned, and they wait. But then they found that there were a bunch of other ballots that had been put in these drop boxes. There's one in every ward. There's one downtown. And they don't have postmarks on them, and they had forgotten about them, so they had to count those as well. And those have no what they call chain of custody. No one has any idea who put them in the box. No one knows, you know, when they put them in the box. They don't know who filled them out. And this really just leads to the broader issue of any ballot that's not cast in person. There is no, like, just to be clear, there's no validation going on of these ballots. They will tell you that they're validating signatures of the ballots. They're not. And challenge, if they showed you the process, you would believe me. In Georgia, you know, in 2020, there was a big controversy about signature validation, meaning when the ballot comes in, you have to sign it. That's how they know it's you, allegedly. Well, it just came out in a court case a month ago that in Georgia there was no signature validation on a couple hundred thousand ballots. Okay. They just decided, they shrugged their shoulders and told us. So this is par for the course. They're not validating these things. So as a result, nobody knows who's casting these ballots. So there's 10,000 in drop boxes. Will more show up? They could. And, yeah, I mean, the late-breaking ballots, shockingly, are all for Clayton Harris, or for the power structure that's in charge, Tony Preckwinkle and Kim Fox. So
but my source,
sorry
for interrupting. My source told me that these were that the drop box was from the actual building, 69 West Washington, where they're headquartered. That they were found there at that location. Is that any validity to that?
They aren't saying where they came from. And if it came from downtown, that means the ballots could be from anywhere in the city. Remember, there's like 55 drop boxes around the city. So have they announced that they picked up from those drop boxes? No. You know, when they with the vote by mail ballots, they actually give you a list of everyone who's requested them. So at least you know these are real people. But in terms of like what drop boxes have been collected, which ones haven't, they haven't revealed it yet. So go ahead.
That Beaver guy though is saying, I mean, we had the statement, right? That he's saying that the ballots that were overlooked, and he sincerely apologizes, that they were, you know, ballots that were postmarked, you know, by election day. So he's seeming to indicate that these were mail-in ballots, but what you're saying is that's not true. They were drop-boxed.
Yeah, the issue is the drop-box ballots, because that's where the most of the hijinks, you know, come in, is that you can put ballots in a drop-box. Anyone can do that. And, again, it's just a fatal flaw of this system. And, as you know, I'm sure, Dan, you've pointed out already on the show this morning that it's greatly ironic that so many of the people who are for Eileen Burke are people who poo-pooed any allegation of voter fraud, and they're the ones who want vote. They want mail-in ballots. They want the drop boxes, and now it's biting them hard.
Yeah, they're Trump conspiracy theorists now. You know, it was a conspiracy theory. There's nothing wrong with drop boxes in the 2020 election. Forget the Dinesh D'Souza documentary and some of the 10,000 mules and all. Forget all that. You know, that's all right wing fever dreams and so on and so forth. And now, hey, they took our Brian Hopkins, the Daily Machine guy. Hey, what's going on here with this election administration? I love it.
Yeah, there is, you know, we've talked about also, there is no other solution other than transparency. And you mentioned the Voter Reference Foundation. Doug Truax, who ran for Senate, lived from Downers Grove, from Chicago. He founded the Voter Reference Foundation a couple of years ago after the debacle of 2020. And the idea behind it was, look, let's just publish all the voter rolls online so that everyone can see who's registered to vote. Let's make sure that every person who's registered is made public. Now, a lot of people hear that and they think, well, I don't want my voter information made public. that's the, you know, the bedrock of democracy, that a person who votes is actually a real person. What people should really be afraid of is that there is no validation process mm-hmm. at all for a registered voter. So you can register the vote anywhere you want. You can give any address you want. The address can be fake. It can be a business. It can be non-existent. It can be an address that's not yours. And they don't check it. They have no way of validating that you're a person, that your address is real. And that's why, so the illegal aliens who've come to Chicago, they could register the vote. There's no way of stopping that. They could give the shelters an address. Fine. If you don't believe it, think about the way that people vote at the Cook County Jail, which I know we've talked about. The Cook County Jail allows all inmates who are there on election day to vote.
Right.
So what does that mean? These people who were arrested that day, a lot of them don't even live in Chicago. They don't live in Illinois. They were just arrested doing something bad in Chicago, and they're in custody. And we've checked this, and they give, you know, the jail is their home address. Does that sound fair? Some guy from Nebraska is here, you know, selling meth, and he gets arrested, and then because he's here, he gets to vote for Congress and for mayor in Chicago. It doesn't sound like it's the spirit of the system.
So what are you guys doing about it? How you're going to FOIA who and for what?
Well, we're asking for the city, and we've asked Mr. Beaver to provide us with a list of who voted. So it's simple. The people who voted, whose ballots were in the drop box, give us a list of who they are so that we know they're legitimate people, and we can check to make sure that these people actually did fill out their own ballots, that these ballots weren't filled out by some organization that just dumped them into the bin. And in addition, also public record is the envelopes on which that these ballots were in. So those envelopes are have signatures on them, and they need to be shown. Because if it's done in a manufactured way, it's pretty obvious. But yeah, I mean, it's real easy. Just tell us who these people are so the people, not just me, but the people of Cook County can validate that they're legitimate people who cast their own ballots. And then everything's great.
By the way, Cook County Jail, which is his own precinct, as somebody was mentioning, that went almost 2-1 for Clayton Harris. I think what happened is they split the vote of the violent offenders, and Clayton Harris cleaned up with the retail thieves. I think that's how that went. So then we were talking about this last week into the weekend that, you know, basically when you were looking at the initial sort of total ballots cast universe, it looked like that, generally speaking, Clayton Harris was slightly underperforming Brandon Johnson, and Eileen Burke was slightly overperforming Paul Vallis, which meant that Eileen Burke was going to win by a slight margin. The magical 10,000 ballots that appeared obviously have brought that race down to, she's up a couple thousand votes with something like 3,500 to be counted. I mean, there's, of course, the supposition about it, but as you were saying, we don't know where the remainder of these votes that have yet to be counted are actually from. And so, you know, we know what the math is, right? If Clayton Harris wins 60% of the remaining ballots to be cast, then he wins. But do you have any intuition about that?
Yeah, I do. All the late mail-in ballots, that came in, which I believe, you know, I believe that people who are mailing their ballots on election day or around then are not, I think a lot of that is organizations voting, you know, harvesting for people. I don't think it's individuals right. who, I don't think individuals just drop their ballot in the mailbox when they could go to the poll and vote. I think this is true for the drop boxes as well. I'm not saying it's universal, but those ballots, the ones that have come in late, have broken significantly higher for Harris. Okay, so I think that's what's going to happen here. Harris outperformed Johnson by about 10 points in black precincts. He got in the low 70s to Johnson's low 80s. So my guess is that they break that way, but it would have to break even a little harder than that if the denominator, the number of ballots that are outstanding, is what they say it is. They say there's 3,500 or so left. some dispute about whether that map is right. But it just seems to me like this is what we've always seen. They'll just keep finding more ballots. So, and they're going to have to go through a process of recounting, reevaluating, maybe curing some of the ballots, some of the provisionals that were filed. So this isn't over. It won't be over for quite some time. And again, the only way people are going to believe in any of this is by by having the government, you know, publish this information online, which they should be doing anyway. It's totally unacceptable that they don't, that they keep the voter rolls a secret just for the political groups who get access to them and nobody else does. This is really how they manipulate them.
Yeah. Develop that a little bit more. So you talked about Doug Truax founding the Vote Reference Foundation and the vision for it. So what why do you think there's or explain, I said, the check on these sorts of election irregularities, that publishing the voter rolls online and keeping them updated. Explain how that checks the system.
He checks the system because people can see, they can log in online and see if they're registered, if their family's registered, and they can see who's registered at their house, who might not be them and their family. They can see if their neighbors, if it checks out that these are their actual neighbors. You'd be surprised. I mean, we lived in River Forest for 10 years, and we had people registered at our house who used to live there who hadn't lived there for 10 years.
Wow.
And that's purposeful. Well, right, but it's purposeful, Amy, because they want to leave the voter rolls messy and overinflated. And Ray Lopez pointed this out, I think, 2 years ago, that in his ward, he knows that that the rolls are inflated. Why? Because when they're inflated, you can vote more, and it doesn't look suspicious. It doesn't look like 100% of people voted. That's why they do it. They don't take people off the rolls. So it's very important that the rolls are clean, but it's also important that the only way to monitor them is have the people to see them themselves. And this is not easy work. You know, that's why when Doug founded this foundation, it was so important, because it's expensive and hard to collect giant data sets and put them online. And he committed to doing that, which has been great all around the country, including here. So, yeah, I mean, as you know, Dan, as a political operative, the voter rolls are controlled by the political people. They have access to them, but the people don't. And if the people did and they saw what was on it, they would know the truth, which is that there are a lot of people registered to vote who don't exist.
Right. And that, and putting it online, as you were describing, allows for sort of a crowd cleaning, you know, instead of crowdfunding, it's a crowd cleaning of the voter rolls. If you start looking at, you know, just even, you know, making sure your address is accurate. Brian Timponi, voteref.com, voteref.com is the voter reference project that we've been discussing, and also, of course, Chicago City Wire and other local publications. Brian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Yeah, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So we have another motion to vacate the speakership. Marjorie Taylor Greene moving to depose House Speaker Mike Johnson after he was party to cobbling together the votes for the minibus, as opposed to the omnibus, minibus, $1.2 trillion and more profligate spending from the Congress, and to stave off, you know, the latest phony, melodramatic, quote-unquote government shutdown, which, as we all know or should by now, is the brief furlough of non-essential government workers. But 20%, 25%, you wouldn't notice it. That's the point. But that happened, and Marjorie Taylor Greene had this to say about it.
Well, this is a complete betrayal of Republican voters across the country. I entered the motion to vacate this morning after Mike Johnson brought part two of an omnibus to the bill to the House floor this morning and forced all of us to vote on a bill that would fund abortion up until full term, that doesn't do anything to secure our border. And this comes after people are seeing this video that's horrifying to every single American, where there's a large group of military-age men, illegals, rushing the border, running over Border Patrol, running over the National Guard. Speaker Johnson totally gave up every ounce of authority he had as House Speaker to use this funding of the government to secure the border for the American people, and it is way past time. He also violated the 72-hour rule. He forced all of us to vote on a bill without amendments. We had no choice. We couldn't introduce amendments. We couldn't fight for the values of our districts. And we had to vote on a bill in one day that had 1,012 pages. These are breaking our conference rules. This is not what Republicans want from a Republican Speaker of the House. And he's basically handed over control to Chuck Schumer.
So even if you disagree with the minibus, is this the best time to try to knock out Mike Johnson? Is this bad timing or is this the best timing actually? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. DA, turnkey.pro text line.
What's her plan? I mean, if not Mike Johnson, who? Did she ever say that? No. Because I don't think she has a plan. Why would she do that? The Republicans were having a great week. We had Bob Alinsky on Capitol Hill testifying. We had that horrific scene that she's talking about at the border. I mean, people's attention is paying. Democrats are not doing a good job right now. You got the Biden crime family. That's what Bob Alinsky. You had that happen at the border again. And she distracts from that and gives them raw meat to chew on. Because the MSNBC, they went nuts over this. And what's her plan? And they asked her, this is, I just want you to hear this. This is her outside the Capitol.
It's filed, but it's not voted on. It only gets voted on until I call it to the floor for a vote.
Right. Jeffries has said he would help potentially, or not he would help, but the Democrats might be willing to help him survive if there was a motion to vacate. Are you worried about putting Johnson in a position where he would actually be beholden to Democrats?
I'm not worried about that at all. I don't think that the American people, Republican voters across the country, want to see a Republican speaker that's held in place by Democrats.
What? Right. So she's using it as a sort of Damocles to hang over the head of Mike Johnson to perhaps release if he continues, I don't know, to do things that she finds objectionable.
Yeah, like funding for Ukraine. She found that objectionable, didn't like that either. But I don't know. I mean, She already has a name for herself. It's not like she needs attention. Why would she do this, Dan?
Well, let's argue on her behalf for the sake of discussion. One might say, well, it was a good week for Republicans, as you just said, but it was a bad week for the country. That scene that we all saw at the border in El Paso with people bum-rushing Border Patrol. That's not a good scene for America. It may be good short-term politically for Republicans, but that's not good for America, and we're supposed to be in the business of doing things that are good for America. And something else I would say, and have said actually, my most recent commentary for American greatness about American innocent bystanders. Everybody's running around calling it an invasion. Except me, I'm calling it an importation, which is what it is. But these Republicans, including Johnson, are saying this is an invasion. Well,
didn't it look like an invasion, Dan, when they knocked down the National Guard?
So if it's an invasion, then do you have a duty to repel it? So if it's an invasion, then wouldn't it be all hands on deck? And all avenues pursued to rebuff the invasion, right? So that would include, say, the power of the purse, the strongest play that House Republicans have to make. Now, I understand the complications that that's a play that a lot of the House Republicans don't want to make, which is evidenced by the vote totals, both in the House and the Senate, for this minibus $1.2 trillion more on the pile. But, this sort of pounding the fist, and this is what it is, and these are exigent circumstances, and this requires a response with urgency, the fierce urgency of now, even, except when it comes to spending. We got to keep that going. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a problematic position, logically, for me. The overheated rhetoric on the description of the problem and the underwhelming response to that description, if that's really the size of the threat. Clay Higgins is a rep from Louisiana, a fellow Bayou Bengal of one Speaker Mike Johnson. He rises in opposition to the move that MTG made.
Which cut would you like played?
Clay Higgins.
Thank you.
I consider Marjorie Taylor Greene to be my friend. She's still my friend. But she just made a big mistake. You know, trying to vacate Mike Johnson's. I totally oppose that. Listen, Mike is a very good man. He begins every day from the right place. He's deeply principled. He's like a brother to me. And to think that one of our Republican colleagues would call for his ouster right now, it's really abhorrent to me, and I oppose it. I stand with Mike Johnson. He is maybe the only guy in history that could potentially perform and help us navigate through these very dark and challenging times when he has to deal with a one-vote majority in the House of Representatives. He's got a Democrat-controlled Senate and a weaponized Democrat-controlled White House. You got one guy that can deal with that. You know who it is? My brother, Mike Johnson. I stand with Mike.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, I stand with Mike on this one, too. I think Clay Higgins is right. I understand the point that MTG is making, but the context is critical. These things are not occurring in a vacuum, and she's being Pollyannish about it. Or worse, I don't know which. But let's take a step back and take a breath here. I don't like the spending bill, but Mike Johnson is I can't think of a more conservative and intellectual, a more conservative legislator with more intellectual heft to lead the Republican caucus. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sorry.
No, I said I agree. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, and so that doesn't necessarily mean he's Winston Churchill. We'll see. This is still in its infancy, but to have these $1.2 trillion minibus, I mean, blips, which it really is. I know it sounds like a crazy statement, but these are crazy times. We put our country in a crazy place. He doesn't have the caucus. This is a conversation we had with McCarthy. He doesn't have the votes. But Johnson, I think, is an improvement over McCarthy, certainly in terms of the intellect and the commitment to conservative principles. He should not easily be thrown over the side because, again, as you said, Amy, there's no consensus alternative.
Right.
And there are all sorts of possibilities that could make things worse. So you escaped once with sort of Gates's impetuous play. I wouldn't tempt fate. And so I think the better play, as should have been made by McCarthy, but they just, animus, I guess, between the two was too great, McCarthy and Gates. The bigger play, I will repeat what I said about those two, is for MTG or Speaker Johnson or whoever has a bone to pick to come together and say, look, none of us like this. A lot of the Republicans that are voting for it don't like it either, but they don't want to get tagged by the media with government shutdown, and that's not a defense. But here is a defense. That's just the reality. And so the reality is you have to give House Republicans more than a couple-seat majority, and because there are some big-spending Republicans. And by the way, there are some districts in this country that will elect big-spending Republicans. And they, if you're not a big-spending Republican, they'll elect a big-spending Democrat instead. So you're not going to get Mike Johnson representing every Republican or Republican-leaning district in the country. It's just never going to happen. So let's deal with reality. It's always going to be a mixed bag when you're talking about 218-plus Republicans in the House, and hopefully, you know, many more than the 218-plus. And then you have to get new leadership in the Republican caucus and a majority there, and obviously the White House. If the American people are truly serious about this, even if the Republican Party is truly serious about this, then in those safe Republican seats, elect more Mike Johnsons and Thomas Massey's and people like that. And in red states, elect more Mike Lee's and Rand Paul's. And if you can't do that, then we will not have the numbers that we need for the fight you want us to have. So, you know, it's easy to say this is how you should have pursued this. This is how you should have won this battle that you can't win. But it's unwinnable given the distribution of power at present. And so rather than firing inside the tent, you know, continue to fire outside the tent, but challenge the American people. I don't know why there isn't a direct challenge to say, this is how it is. I don't like it. So, but this is a representative republic. If this is what you like, then keep sending people like these Vichy Republicans and big spending new Marxists to D.C., and you'll keep getting what you're getting. If you don't like it, then here are some models that you should try to replicate in the districts, in the district in which you live. That seems to me the challenge, and use this as an opportunity to present a united front rather than a divisive one of who's sort of more pure than the other.
312-642-5600. A lot of people want to weigh in on this. Greg in Rogers Park. Good morning. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. I respectfully disagree. I'm sick and tired of continual spending and spending, the inflation going up, the debt is just awful for our economy. And I think, whether you like her or not, I think she's courageous that she's at least willing to put up a fight for what she believes in. Now, I agree that Danny's not the worst of the worst and all that, but I still think that right now we've got to have somebody that will stand up to the spending. And at least she's got more courage than any of the idiots here in Illinois. And you know, I just think it's the right thing to do, and whatever happens, happens. But I think it's time, you know, somebody stands up to what's right rather than what's going to look good with the fake news media. Thank you.
Well, I then rather than making it about Mike Johnson, then MTG should take the substantive position. So what would you do? What would you do if you were Speaker, MTG? We make you Speaker tomorrow. What would you do here?
Right.
Would you make the case to shut the government down? Because I haven't heard you say that. To quote-unquote shut the government down. I know it's a fraud, but just use this as a handle for the discussion. Would you make the case? You're going to lose the vote, you know that. And then you're going to lose, basically, you're going to lose control of your caucus because you have a healthy plurality, if not a majority, of the caucus, your caucus, that doesn't want to do that and is not going to vote for it. So are you willing to die on that sword? And by the way, then you're out the next day because – you just alienated half your caucus, let's say. And remember, just as it just took one member to enter a motion to vacate mm-hmm. the speakership, so can one of those Vichy Republicans, one of the squishy middle of the road Republicans that likes to spend and is afraid of the press. They can make a motion to vacate you. And this will just go on and on and on in perpetuity. Instead of these personality fights, make an argument and make an argument that goes out towards the American people, not an internecine one. Out towards the American people. This is what we need. This is what we should do. This is what I would like to do, but I don't have the votes. I don't hear that from MTG. And I didn't hear that from Gates either.
Anthony and Juliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call. I agree with Representative Clay and Dan. This is not the time to be playing games, playing Russian roulette. I mean, we've got such a fragile majority as it is. All it would take is one of those or a handful of those Vichy Republicans to swing against us. And then who are we going to get? Hakeem Jeffries as Speaker of the House? How will that do us any good?
Right. Thanks for the call.
Quickly, let's go to Tom. Hold on 1 second. Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. We do hear that Mike Johnson's a nice guy and everything, and I understand it's a slim majority, but is it a majority at all if everything that's considered a deal almost seems to exclusively benefit the Democrats?
Well, I mean, again, you have a sizable percentage of the House Republican caucus that think it benefits, that thinks it benefits them. I mean, the idea, the way that people talk about this as if the House Republican caucus is a monolith that's sharing a brain. And it just isn't. It just isn't. Frankly, it's somewhat fortunate that you have conservative leadership in the House Republicans as you do. It could easily be a Mitch McConnell Republican as the House Speaker, too. So I just be careful. And like I said, you know, they get to play too. Mm-hmm. So do you want to depose Mike Johnson so that someone from the left side of the conservative ranks or the Republican ranks, some establishmentarian moves on, you know, the next one to replace Mike Johnson. And then you just go back and forth here. One from our faction and then one from your faction. And you do so, and we'll find the thinly veiled predicate to take your person out, and then you'll do the same to ours, and this just goes on and on into the November election. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Kevin in Austin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You're right on this. People, you have to be more tactical. Fools rush in where wise men fear to tread, and in this instance, you're going to make more trouble. The election is, I don't know how far away, how many days. And that's what you have. That's, I think, strategically that people have to focus on now. I did want to comment what you said earlier as far as, you know, not having sympathy for people who vote for Democrats, things like that. But I do have sympathy for people who don't know how the system works. And they don't even probably know that DuPage County is divided up into 9 different townships and how to get involved politically. In Naperville, there are only 28 of the 58 precinct chairs that are filled. You've got to figure out locally how you're going to change it. You got to get both the most Republican or the most conservative you can where you are. Like you said, it's, you know, vote more conservative people in the strong Republican conservative districts. Vote as conservative as you can where you live. So.
Thanks, Kevin.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The defendants also claim they are above the law insofar as any decision made by the city, and no claim for breach of trust merits judicial review, including the lease of over 19 acres of prime public parkland in historical Jackson Park for $10. That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, wow.
Pretty good lease deal. 19 acres of prime parkland in Jackson Park for $10. A transfer of historic Jackson Park to the Obama Foundation, thereby wrecking the park's entire roadwork system and desecrating the historical integrity of Frederick Law Olmsted's master plan. The district, in so doing, the district court has gutted, the rules of civil procedure, ignore the rules against delegating legislative decisions to private interested parties. And brief filed by Professor Richard Epstein on behalf of Protect the Parks goes on along those lines, which is the whole story here, it seems to me, is that there is one set of rules for everybody else and another set of rules for Obama. That probably doesn't come as a surprise, generally speaking, but when it comes to public land, prime public parkland, as was described, that is an interesting precedent that's being set. And golly gee, one wonders what fight over the possibility of a new Bear Stadium on the lakefront might look like if it were to come. Professor Richard Epstein is the James Parr Hall Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's always happy to come here, even if the topic is a bit of a grip.
Well, this is a long-running saga, of course, and the Obama Foundation folks are proceeding ahead as if there is no concern about the law or the financing of their project, interestingly, as well, which is another topic we've discussed in terms of what they promised, where they promised they'd be in terms of the financing and where they actually are. But sort of just give us the stop, look, and listen at where the case stands and what you think the prospects are that anything is going to change.
Well, I'm not optimistic about all this, and I think the word stop is perfectly operative. I've been involved with the case roughly since the summer of 2019, and the procedural and substantive obstacles that we have faced have been unbelievable. Right now, the case is sitting before the Seventh Circuit in an oral argument that I made on October 24th of last year. It's a little bit more than 5 months, and they've not issued an opinion. And we raised three sorts of challenges, all of which I think are kind of decisive. And let me sort of be simple. First of all, you mentioned the 99-year lease. You misspoke. They changed the word of lease to use. And they did that because a 99-year lease would be subject to a public trust doctrine. And they thought if they reworked the language, they'd be able to get away from that. And by God, that's exactly what Judge Blakey did. He said, you
even
want
better.
Magic words, please be my guest. And so we're trying to fight that. Of course, you know, a rose is a rose by any other name, and they have exclusive possession for 99 years, as any other tenant would have. But so far, they've been able to escape that charge. The $10 fee is not for the lifetime use, but it's only for 99 years, right? give them back 3 cents. The first thing about that, then they have to finance the thing and so forth. And what the contracts say is, we may be giving you the land, but we're not giving you all the work for the building. And so they had to meet strict financial targets. And there were two of these targets. One of them is they had to put enough reserve aside to build the building. And the other one was that they had to put enough reserves aside to create an endowment in order to keep the thing going. Well, they've done neither. But nobody seems to mind. So in 2021, they reported, well, we're ready to build this building. We have $485 million in assets, and this building is only going to cost us $482 million, unaudited. And those numbers are very fishy. Then by the time you got a little bit further along, even that was a pretense, because now the cost of the building in the summer of 21 went up to about $700 million by their auditing. The current figure is about $800 million by their auditing. My guess is it's probably higher than that, but they never did the second financing that you had to do in order to close the project. They just closed it and ignored the rules. So they're obviously in breach of their contract because these were strict condition precedent. when I was asked by Judge Hamilton, isn't there a good faith waiver for that? I said, only if you want to do all contract law for the last 1,000 years. Are the rule in this case?
Well, that doesn't seem like a big deal. Yeah. Well, just undo contract law for 1,000 years? That's not a big deal.
No, go back to Roman time. They had a remedy, which is that the contract has been disregarded in every respect. Well, what they said is if you can't close on this day, you can defer closing without a penalty, and when you get the money, then you could start building. Well, they didn't do the second order. They closed on the 18th, and on the 21st of August in 2021, they knocked down 300 or so trees. They have promised to rebuild the woman's garden, one of the things that was desecrated. There is no timetable as to when it will be done. There is no budget that's been put together. There are no plans that have been developed. It's a bare promise, which is worth the paper it isn't written on. And so you get things. So you get those two things. So you get the public trust doctrine, which is a steal, and there are hundreds of millions of dollars that the city and the federal government are putting in. And then what you do is you get this fake arrangement in which what they do is they claim that they're entitled to get the conveyance. Since that time, they've not raised much money towards this project. They reported last year a $331 million gift. Well, that sounds pretty impressive until you break it down. But a large portion of that was dedicated to other projects, about $125 million. And then there was another gift which was not dedicated to the building but could be used to pay their annual expenses, which between fees and outside things and salaries and the like is close to $80 million a year. They run a very rich operation. They got only about $120 million or something like that in new money, and the sources of funding are drying up, and their commitments continue to get enlarged. We try to get an audit on this, and we filed a paper with Judge Blakey on, I think it was January 5th, 2022. And by January 6th, he said, you're out of court, young man. Why? He says, because you're pleading as a third-party beneficiary. The first line of our brief was, this is not a third-party beneficiary case. This is a breach of trust case. A third-party beneficiary, for people who don't know this bit of legal language, is A and B enter into a contract to purport a benefit to C. And the question is whether C can sue to get that benefit. And most people want to reserve the right to alter the contract before repayment or payment is made. And so what happened is they deny enforceability, even if the law would normally allow it. And we knew that when we filed our papers. But you can't breach a fiduciary duty by saying nobody could bring a third-party action. And what this did, by the way, is it slowed us up the course for 2 years in bringing the appellate case. And we still have yet to get a look at the books, having made a complaint that these guys are completely insolvent relative to what they've done. You know that ex-President Obama prides himself on transparency, right?
This oh, yes.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I got it. I mean, this is buried in so many deep crypts. Nobody has even seen the internal plans of how this thing is going to operate. What they do is they simply maintain a wall of silence in the press. And if you look at their annual report, it's so sketchy as to be embarrassing on the finances. In 2021, when they thought they actually could make the money, they said, well, we know we're behind the eight ball, but we could raise $300 million a year in order to capture this thing by 2025 when it was supposed to open. But that was a pipe dream, and it was illegal anyhow. They have to have the money in hand. You're not allowed to build buildings on the promise that you'll be able to raise the money for it, and they have gotten that away with that. And so when I get into the Seventh Circuit, it's all wonderland on those two things. Well, then there's the environmental claims and so forth, the NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act claim, the disclosures you have to make in order to keep this thing going, right? Well, what happens is they started with the prospect that they were going to build. This was the project. They were going to build a presidential center in Jackson Park. They told you where it was going to go, and you had to close down a bunch of roads in order to do this and expand other roads. So it's a transportation project, and you had to go through all of this. So we spent about 18 months going through all of this, starting in 2019. And then in early 2022, they said, oh, that's not what the project is. We're not building the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park. How silly can you be? What we are doing is we're just widening two roads and closing a third. And they said they could close the third road, i.e. Cornell Drive, without getting government approval, which is just flatly wrong. And then they said, well, since the only thing we're doing is widening the road, the fact that these guys, i.e. the plaintiffs, have presented a plan to build a much superior operation west of the Washington Park on private land, well, that really doesn't matter anymore because we changed the definition. Well, that's just flatly illegal in the way in which you run things. And then, well, you have to figure out what's going on. And Judge Wood made the following deduction, which I will leave you to decide. She said, well, we cut down, you know, large numbers of trees with 30-inch diameters in their base, but we're going to replace them one-to-one. So by 10 years from now, by the time this building is finished, we will plant saplings of 2 to 4 inches. And she says, but don't worry.
Oh my God.
There are lots of other trees in Jackson Park where the birds can nest and so forth. But there's never been a single case underneath where you could chop down cheese and say, well, there are a lot more cheese trees in the universe. I mean, to talk about it, it's kind of like a joke to see that, but that's what's happening. So in the long run, it's going to be just fine.
So well, let me tell you something. If you're not careful, you're not going to be invited to shoot hoops with Obama and Giannoulias. I'm just warning you. You know,
well,
you're
one. He's a good basketball player. I wish you'd stick to that trade.
Well, so it was supposed to open in 2025. Is there any
2026? Well, it's
2026. Yeah.
Well, 2026. You understand most of these centers are built on humane scale. Many people say, it's a presidential library. No such luck. It was sold as one in 2015, early on. But the requirements to build them mean that you can't build it over 70 feet high. And this tower is about 235 feet. And it's the worst kind of architecture. If you look at it, it looks like a battlement. And you're doing saying, well, where do they keep the guns that they could fire in the lake in case somebody wants to invade? It's just much too massive for the place, and it completely dominates the skyline. But it sits like a sick cancer over everything that's going on.
I haven't seen the updated plans, but I hope there is like some sort of like version of Christ the Redeemer outside of Rio, but it's Obama outside of Chicago. Is that part of the development? Because I think that would be a nice touch for the lakefront.
I think there should be a statue of one kind or another. What they do is they have some saying that he wrote, and they put it on the top of the building as if you could read it. And so what it does is it looks like this weird kind of mosaic for no particular reason of what's going on. Look, we cannot oppose this on aesthetic grounds if you're going into the court. But it's certainly on aesthetic grounds you could start to look at it and to realize it's just much too massive, and they're closing roads so they can move it further north. So that everybody can see it from both ends of the Midway and along the lakefront, a citadel of the good man sitting out there. I mean, this is, in fact, a very sad situation. And so why does one fight it? I mean, I don't know whether we'll get any luck in the Seventh Circuit this time. We've not gotten a single ruling in our favor in the 4.5 years that I've been. And every ruling, starting from the worst one that Judge Andy Barrett, now Justice Andy Barrett, did, they've all been just, I think, indefensible on every legal ground of which I'm aware. You said that they're playing by two different rules. You're wrong. There's one set of rules for everybody else, and there's no set of rules.
Right.
Dealing with the Obama Foundation. I mean, it's clout of the kind of order. And, you know, he's a genius at keeping the publicity down. And so what do you see about Obama? You see him looking at the plans with adoring eyes. You see him looking at the lakefront arm in arm with her. And you see him wearing a construction hat turning dirt over. That's what they do. How many times have you asked them to come on the show?
Oh, yeah,
that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the... Well, are you guys going to get involved? Is your organization going to get involved with a potential new Bears stadium along the lakefront?
Well, let me put it to this way. Somebody else will have to take that one on. When you talk about this, we sound very impressive, Protect Our Parks, but we're a very tiny organization. The Bears Stadium, I don't even know what the plans are. I think it sounds to me quite lunatic for a whole variety of reasons. Namely, the appropriate place for a Bears Stadium is by White Sox Stadium, where they can share common facilities at different times of the year. Many years ago, in 2003, I worked on this particular issue. Michael Rackless is working with me on this case. And we tried desperately to see if we could stop the renovation of the old Soldier Field, which was a massive desecration of the stadium. And it was a much simpler case than this one. But we got tossed out of court with strong warnings, don't you ever do this again. But we actually prepared, as we did in this case. We had a very fine architectural firm prepare a dome stadium that would be by, not by Soldier Field, but by the White Sox Stadium, where you could take access of a real good freeway system in order to get it. Access along the Lakeshore Drive to any major facility is very difficult because when you buy a lakefront, you don't have easy access on a cross grid. So where we wanted to build the thing in Washington Park, you got the red line, you got the green line, you have Martin Luther King Drive, you got Garfield Road, you got the freeway. Everyone can get in there. There's only one way to get into the Obama Presidential Center, and that's in a cul-de-sac. And then you have to turn around, and there's only one entrance that you have to use for security, for deliveries, for employees, and for customers. So the building itself is absolutely crazy. So
well,
we thought it's very sad, but that should be built not on the lakefront. That's for sure.
That's going to be like Hotel California. You can enter, but you can never leave the Obama Library. Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer, University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thank you for your yeoman-like effort with respect to and protect our parks with a yeoman-like effort against the library. Good luck. Appreciate it.
Okay, it's not a library, remember.
No, it's a wonderland. It's
Obama land, yeah.
Yeah, right.
They took the name off because they couldn't build a library given regulations. It's all a con.
It's all a con. That should be the name of it.
Conland.
That should be the name. It's all a con. I like that.
All right. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you all for being here. Exactly 4 years ago tomorrow, during those first terrifying days of the pandemic, the man who many would soon to come to regard as America's doctor was in the White House press room. He was seated behind our then president, a man who, you may recall, had a few ideas of his own about the virus. As the former president expounded on one of those theories, Dr. Fauci buried his face in his hand. That brief gesture, the famous Fauci facepalm, went viral instantly with the words, "We are all Dr. Fauci." In truth, there is only one Dr. Anthony Fauci. He is a deeply caring physician, a brilliant scientist, an extraordinary public servant, a humanitarian, and a patriot whose work has helped save tens of millions of lives in this nation and around the world, which is why it's an honor to join the University of Illinois system in acknowledging the worthy recipient of this year's Senator Paul Douglas Ethics in Government Award, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Those were the profound words of Senator Durbin. Those were the profound words of one senior senator, Sack of Durbin, presiding over the conference of this very deserved award. Go Illini. Okay. And a related story, I'll let you just sort of insert your own vomit in response to that. In a related story out of Germany, speaking of Fauci, they press outlets there were able to obtain about 2,500 pages that documented the meetings of the COVID crisis team between January of 2020 and April of 2021. This was long-running litigation by journalists at Multipolar to get these communications. And the details are really interesting. The blogger, Substacker, Eugypius, has some of the highlights if you want to check it out. Their CDC is the RKI. Just for purposes of describing. So there are moments, just a couple of points from this. Again, it's going to confirm what you suspect to be true, but it's good color. Intriguing moment in the minutes on March 16th, 2020, where we read that preparations had been completed to raise the overall pandemic risk assessment that was then at moderate. As soon as some person who's redacted in the email, probably the health minister, should give the signal. That happened the next day when the RKI suddenly decided on no clear basis that COVID risk was high. On March 16th, you'll remember, that's when Neil Ferguson in Imperial College posted their notorious paper calling for rolling lockdowns and the projection that, you know, for this country, 2 million Americans would die, you remember.
Right.
This accords
2 to 3 million, yeah.
This accords with much other evidence suggesting that COVID measures were a prior political decision that required exaggerating the danger. That's the point. At multiple points, the RKI, again, their CDC in Germany, the RKI acknowledged that COVID was far less dangerous than they publicly allowed. On December of 16th of 2020, at the start of the second nearly unending German lockdown, writes Eugypius, we find them discussing lockdowns in Africa and noting that they have consequences that are in part worse than the consequences of COVID itself. Direct quote. On March 19th of 2021, they emphasized that, quote, COVID-19 should not be compared with influenza because normal influenza waves kill more people.
Oh boy.
Although COVID-19 is worrying for other reasons. On masks, they were in October 30, 2020, communication. Completely skeptical about the effectiveness of the N95 masks. They called for N95 for health professionals only. Without correct fit, when used by untrained personnel, the masks would have no effect, quote. Mandating N95s for community protection was therefore not evidence-based, their words, because there was no reason to think they would work outside of professional healthcare settings. They even suggested the public should be made aware of this, which never happened. Within a few months, the N95 mask mandates were imposed anyway. Eugypius' commentary on this and much more that's included in these communications. We were all called lunatics, hobby virologists, conspiracy theorists, and worse for our doubts that COVID was all that dangerous, that lockdowns were worth it, that mask mandates made any sense, and that excluding the unvaccinated from public life was remotely justifiable. A lot of us were banned and ostracized for saying these things. The RKI release shows that our public health managers were having exactly the same discussions in private the entire time. The exact same discussions as, you know, commonsensical laymen in America or Germany the whole time. Our politicians told us all of this lunacy was necessary because we had to follow the science. In fact, the scientists were mere tools of the prior political decision to force this entire pandemic theater upon us. They functioned merely to lend the pandemic policies about which they themselves nourished hidden doubts, a pseudoscientific aura. Now, he says the worst thing is that nothing will come of this. The worst thing here is that not only nothing will come of it, but we have to bear witness to Tony Fauci receiving awards from university systems. For more on all of this, I'm not letting this go. We're pleased to be joined by Carol Markowitz, columnist for the New York Post. Excuse me. Oh, my gosh. I slandered
her.
New York Post, co-author of the bestseller Stolen Youth, How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. She's also host of the Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. Carol, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I love that you are not letting up on this. I will never get over what was done to us. And this is so important to keep hitting and not to let Anthony Fauci become some kind of hero of the pandemic when he caused so much damage to all of us.
Yeah. And it's great that there are other efforts in the West, in places like Germany, clearly among some media outlets, to pull all the stuff that was happening in the back rooms out into the sunlight for everyone to see, so that maybe you get some reckoning, at least among some, or maybe you get some, recognition of what happened, mm-hmm. so that there are more skeptics the next go around, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, the fact that this might not be our last pandemic and et cetera, and we need to know what really went on so that we don't repeat it, is something that all Americans should want. It's not just people on the right, it's not just Republicans, etc. It should be everyone asking what happened here. Why did my kids' schools stay closed for, you know, over a year? Why did this all go on with no evidence? Where were the scientists to speak up, and why were they shut down when they tried to? All of that should be answered going forward.
I mean, just another related story. We have to make sure we tell these stories here because they're not going to be told in very many other places. This lawsuit that was filed against the FDA by some Texas doctors with respect to the FDA's social media posts about ivermectin, the FDA has agreed to settle, and they're taking down these social media posts, these incendiary social media posts that were used to ridicule people like Joe Rogan permanently. And they're not to repost them as terms of the settlement. And it's not that they're saying ivermectin is a good treatment for COVID, and that can be debated. But what they said that was clearly false is that, you know, they ridiculed it. They say ivermectin's for animals and not for humans. And that's not true. And they just essentially conceded that what they were saying wasn't true, the FDA.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, 4 years later, you know, I don't know when the ivermectin posts went up, but it's been quite a while. So it's taken them years to admit where they've made mistakes. Again, the concern to me is, like, if it's taking them this long this time, it just they also are learning the lessons of how to better control people next time, how to better massage their message next time. And I worry about all of that. I love that you guys are still on this, because I just feel like so many people just want to move on, and we can't move on. We can't move on because nobody has been held accountable. Nobody has apologized. Absolutely nobody. So, you know, we need to keep hitting this.
Yeah, but we're still in it. I mean, I have two jobs, and both of my jobs, if I get COVID, I have to stay away for 5 days.
Wow, yeah.
And that's people don't realize that that's still happening. That's still happening in Chicago public schools, too. No, regardless of what the CDC says, that, you know, it should be treated like the flu, we're still in this. And, I've asked our HR director, I've asked, you know, my other job, too, like, when are we going to end this nonsense? Because I'll show them the CDC comment, and they have no end date. I think they're going to keep on doing this.
Right. It doesn't even matter what the CDC says anymore. Now it's become such a part of their lives that they won't let go of it. It should worry people. It's mass mania. You know, I'm actually waving to you guys across from Lake Michigan. I'm in Michigan right now, and I was in Ann Arbor this weekend, and I think they haven't heard that masking has stopped largely across the country. Yeah. I feel like we should send an email, because the masking was intense. It was so many people, so many young, healthy-looking people masking for no reason. And in the same way that we used to mask, you know, when we didn't know anything in, like, April 2020. And it just, they come into a restaurant masked. They sit down and have their meal unmasked. Like, what are you doing? What have you heard that you think that this works for something?
The best and brightest matriculating at the University of Michigan. Yeah, right. I wanted to get to something else, too, speaking of a bit of hysteria. This is coming from the White House, because there are domestic political concerns that need to be served at the expense of Israel's effort to come as close as possible to eradicating Hamas. Kamala Harris warning that there will be consequences if Israel invades Rafah to try to, you know, ostensibly deal a kill shot to Hamas. And she's partnering up with Emmanuel Macron, who is warning of a possible war crime were Bibi to pursue Hamas in Rafah.
Israel has absolutely no choice but to go into Rafah. Leaving Hamas in charge in Rafah is just, it would be an insult to all the soldiers that have died, all the hostages that have been killed. There's no way they cannot go into Rafah. I think they have to absolutely ignore Kamala Harris. And even Joe Biden, when he said, you know, Rafah's the red line, he ended up walking that back and said, no, you can make some targeted strikes. I was just in Israel. This is a country that understands that they're under an existential threat. They know that if they don't finish the job now, they're going to keep having attacks where their own people die in these terrorist attacks. So they are motivated to finish the job I don't think Kamala Harris looking at the maps is going to change anything. She had a comment yesterday studying the maps of Rafah. So good luck with that. But it is absolutely necessary for them to finish the job. You know, I came back from Israel and I wrote a piece about it for Fox News. And my opening line about it was somebody in Israel had said to us that the 2006 war that they had with Lebanon ended the way all of their wars end, when their greatest ally, America, says that's enough. Well, they realize at this time they can't let America say that's enough. They have to finish the job.
Mm-hmm. I also know what Kamala Harris is studying the maps. She might want to take a look, see at that border wall between Egypt and Gaza. It's very, very interesting that they have such a stringent, secure border that Egypt mans to keep Gaza denizens out.
To follow that. Somehow they have policies. You cannot cross that border wall. And if you do, well, that will be big trouble for you. As opposed to us, who, if you cross our, you know, our borders, our gates, our walls, whatever you get across, you get to stay. That's your you win. You get a prize for being able to cross our border illegally. It's just insane. I was also at our southern border shortly before my Israel trip, just seeing the insanity that goes on down there, that these people are dressed. I saw migrants coming in, illegal immigrants, whatever you want to call them. They're dressed better than us. They are in mm-hmm. Prada sneakers and like fancy clothes with the latest iPhones. And I was a refugee to this country when I was a small child from the Soviet Union. I assure you, my parents came in with like $100 total, and they were not dressed better than you guys were. They were very humble migrants, not migrants. They were refugees, and they, you know, came into a country seeking shelter. These people are not seeking that. They're seeking, I don't even know what, because none of them were working in agriculture either. That was another discovery that, you know, I had made it at the border. Agriculture jobs are not being filled by these people. So where are they going and what are they doing? Can Kamala Harris study that, please?
Yes. She's writing points on that one, too. She's got a lot on her plate.
Well, according to U.S. News, in February alone, we had 190,000 enter, $25 million worth of drugs, 300 pounds of fentanyl, and 70 who were on the FBI terror watch list. So if we don't do something soon, I'm so worried that something's going to happen like it did in Russia over the weekend.
Yeah, that should be a pressing concern. That should be what we're all worried about, because it doesn't need to be as splashy as what happened in Russia. It doesn't need to be like a giant, you know, the 9/11 style terrorist attack. It could literally be them getting across the border and hurting kids at a school, you know, in a border town. It could be things like that. I think we need to take this so seriously. Our border is in such big trouble. Being down there was just really terrifying. You know what the problems are from far away, but when you're there and you see how close Mexico is and how easy it is for them to come across, and the fact that when they make it, they're rewarded with a stay, it's crazy. We are doing crazy, crazy things that I think that Americans need to be on fire about. I think we need to really be scared and worried, because we're letting people in. We're not checking anybody. We have no idea who they are or where they're going. I mean, just little things like we're letting in hundreds of thousands of people. Where are they going? Have you ever rented an apartment without showing proof of income, proof of like employment?
Never.
How are hundreds of thousands of people renting space in our country? What are they doing? Who are they? These are all questions that the Biden administration just is not answering.
Well, they've got some social media influencers that are helping to teach them about squatters' rights. So that's an assist. You know, they don't have to worry about pesky things like leases and purchases and so forth. Carol Markowitz is a columnist for The New York Post, co-author of Stolen Youth: How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. She's also the host of The Carol Markowitz Show on iHeartRadio. Carol, thank you as always.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The bum rushing of border security in the El Paso sector that everyone was talking about as the incident went viral drew this response from White House spokeswoman Corinne Jean-Pierre, KJP. Well, what you saw there is the fault of Republicans.
I really, truly believe that's a question for, the Republican governor of Texas, right? This is something that he should address, that he should actually speak to. The president has worked with Congress in the Senate, as I just spoke to, about getting an immigration bill done, making sure that we deal with the border challenges that we're now seeing. And you have a governor of Texas who has continued to politicize this. I do want to say we are grateful for the Border Patrol's quick work to get the situation under control and apprehend the migrants. So that's important. But congressional Republicans need to move on this.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was thank you for apprehending them so that you could usher them in, escort them into the country, which, of course, is what will happen. Donald Trump had a message over the weekend that he posted before the conversation turned to what he can or can't post today with respect to that judgment in Manhattan. This is continuing the thematic that's been a Trump staple ever since the murder of Laken Riley, Biden's border bloodbath.
It's Biden's border bloodbath. There's never been anything like it. Every day, Joe Biden is setting loose thousands of unvetted, unscreened, military-aged men into the United States from parts unknown. Americans like Laken Riley and Travis Wolf are being murdered, and they're being murdered. It's horrible what's going on. Our people are being murdered. You have to understand, people are pouring into our country at levels that we've never seen before. 15 million people, in my opinion, thus far. It'll be close to 20 million people by the time we get this guy out. That's almost bigger than any state in the union. And they're coming in from jails and prisons. They're coming in from mental institutions and insane asylums. They're terrorists. They're human traffickers. And they traffic in women. That's what they want to traffic in. That's what they want to do. And we had it almost stopped. We had the safest border in history. Now we have the worst border probably in the history of the world. Every day, innocent citizens are being killed, stabbed, shot, raped, and murdered because of Biden migrant crime. It's a new word, a new term. It's migrant crime, but we call it Biden migrant crime because he's responsible for it 100%. Yet the same fake news media that is pushing one hoax after another never wants to talk about that.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Chris Klemm, former Yuma Sector Border Patrol Chief. Chris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be on. Always good to be on in Chicago. You know, I'm very fond of that city. I spent, I guess, about 6 weeks up there about 10 years ago, 12 years ago at Chicago Booth. And obviously my friend Brian Urlacher, Chicago Bear legend, I've taken him down the border a couple of times. So good to be on the radio and on the air in Chicago.
It's interesting you say that because after Urlacher's visits to the border, he was pretty outspoken. He came on our show and talked about his experience, too. And this is a while back already. But everybody could see what was happening. And then basically what we've seen, as far as I can tell, is the Biden administration using an accelerant of invitation to come. And word gets around pretty quickly in circles that want to come to this country or want to move people into this country, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That criminal network is so rapid. Anytime there's been any kind of adjustment or change in policy, good, bad, or otherwise, they have a way to connect back to source countries, back to the network, to either say, keep coming, or hold up, don't come here, come someplace else. And in the accelerant was basically 94 executive orders within the first hours and days and months of this administration that did undo everything that we had worked towards, to secure the border. And for your listeners, look, I joined in 1995. I worked for five administrations, and every administration had taken steps to secure the border except this one. It actually went backwards. It undid and stopped all the hard work, and that hard work was requirements from our agents, not bureaucrats, not elected officials, what the agents needed. And really, and the numbers don't lie. You see it go from just under 500,000 in 2020 to 1.5 million to 2.2 million to close to 3 million last year. This is policy driven straight out of the White House. And everybody got to see what those policies can do based on that viral video from Thursday that happened in El Paso. And somebody who spent a lot of his career in El Paso, just, yeah, it's just disgusting to see what this administration has done.
And the thing about El Paso, because I used to work at KVIA in El Paso, and I called them. They said, well, that video is from Thursday. It happened on Wednesday, too. So it wasn't just a one-day thing. It happened Wednesday and Thursday. But also, too, I think there's a financial incentive because we had so many people sleeping in tents outside of police stations. And the thing is, they were getting money for housing, but they were pocketing that money and sending it to their relatives to bring them here.
Yeah, well, you know what? Back to that event, that's been happening probably regularly in El Paso. Mm-hmm. It just so happened they had a reporter with their cameraman there that captured the whole thing at that specific time, because we know what happened through it later during the day. But again, they've gotten it back under control in that area, or at least limited the access. So we're not going to see that again, because something this administration is big on is securing their narrative and not securing the border. You heard that from the press secretary. I mean, look, if this kind of event happened in Washington, they'd call it an insurrection. If it happened at a concert, it'd be a riot. But it happens at the border, and they blame Republicans. They blame the state that is trying to do something about it. That's what they're going to do. And, you know, it's ridiculous. This administration is about an immigration fix, not a border security fix. So just listen to what they say. They want to fix an immigration problem. That's facilitating more people in. It starts with securing the border. Then we can start working on who and what and when and where they come in. But it's got to be with a secure border first. Then we can open up the ports of entry to lawful pathways to kind of minimize some of this nonsense that's going on. But, yeah, it's actually hear what they don't say versus what they say.
Well, right. The folly of Greg Abbott's responsible for what happened in El Paso while they're litigating the law that was signed, what he signed into law to deputize local law enforcement to essentially act in significant measure as border security. But well, that's, you know, just attendant to the politics of the day. I wonder what your reaction is to the pronouncements that Trump has been making on the campaign trail that there's going to be, if he is elected, there's going to be a mass deportation program, because there just has to be. Even if there is the desire to do that, how realistic is removing a significant portion of the, you know, let's say 7 to 10 million people who've entered this country and have been allowed to enter this country illegally over the last 3 years? How realistic is that? With the, you know, the mechanics of it, what would be required in order to accomplish something like that?
Well, as far as logistics and getting it done, I mean, it could get done. I seriously doubt the political will be there from, you know, both sides of the aisle to support it in the manner that the president has been talking about. But there's also a Fourth and Fifth Amendment due process issue, because many of these people have been served, you know, notices to appear and are in a legal process.
Right.
That would be a problem. However, there is a large contingent of people that have been paroled in, which in mass, which is what the flights coming from other countries, and that I think is still a constitutional issue. But the president of the United States does have the control to determine that parole. So I think the hundreds of thousands and close to millions of people that have been paroled in, that could be done with minimum impact or zero impact to any due process, because that parole is controlled by the executive. Those that have been placed in removal proceedings, that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, because they have a right to due process under our Constitution. Whether we like it or not, we do have to uphold the Constitution. So I think that there will be a message sent. I think if President Trump is elected and he starts doing that right there will shut things down, because they know they're not going to get that multiple bite at the apple that they're given under this administration. So logistically, I mean, there's people out there that can go out there and make the arrest, but it will be an undertaking for sure.
Well, the parole program, that's a good example of what can be done immediately. And even with respect to processing asylum claims, adjudicating asylum claims. Yeah, absolutely. If you follow the Constitution, and provide due process. But that can also be done more expeditiously, perhaps with more immigration judges or whatever the stumbling blocks are in the system. There's no reason that these asylum cases have to go on for years and years, just like cases in our courts, generally speaking, in this country. So, you know, there are fixes to that as well that still comport with, constitutional strictures. But I wanted to ask you about the parolee program, because this has gotten some attention. And you talked about serving under five different presidents. Is what Biden has done unprecedented? The report of 300,000 plus migrants being flown at taxpayer expense from foreign lands to dropped off at some 43 different airports around the country. Has there ever been anything like that?
No. This is nothing like we've ever experienced or seen. That is taking a very limited and specific program and bastardizing and just basically using it for their own good and for their own agenda. Look, paroling people in for humanitarian and limited interest of government, we've had that authority. I've used that authority for witnesses to parole them in to testify on behalf of the government in a crime. Mm-hmm. When you have certain things like a temporary protective status because something has happened in the source country or the home country and we can't get them back, it's very limited. Paroling people in because they claim they want to come to the United States for asylum or some kind of relief, and parole, well, I think there's been over 300,000 flown in. I mean, that is an abuse of a system, an abuse of power, and I do think it's unconstitutional because only that's creating a set demographic of people, and under immigration law, only Congress can do that. So I think it's gonna be very hard to uphold that in courts. So we just got to get it there and challenge it. But that is one of those areas that the next president very much could shut down and remove every one of those parolees.
What's your reaction? I mean, we have this devolution into chaos, more chaos than usual in Haiti. I mean, that's a country of 11 million people. The Dominicans aren't letting them in. They have a border fence that they man with and with some severity too, historically. So there's some talk about using Gitmo as a processing center for those who flee. And a lot of these Haitians are going to have legitimate asylum claims with respect to the violence that's going on there, political persecution potentially. We've heard from Ron DeSantis about scrambling his National Guard at sort of a point of entry around the Florida coast. How do you think we should be thinking about the potential refugee crisis from Haiti that compounds what we've already inflicted upon ourselves at the border?
Yeah, so you bring up Haiti, which is a great example of where we should be, using asylum for those that do have to flee because of the uprising and the political, back and forth and just overtaking that's happened. That's a good use of asylum, not false claiming because you want to benefit here. So that's one thing. And the sad part is that we've overloaded the system the last couple years. That's going to make it that much more challenging for them. But we should, you mentioned Gitmo. I think we should maximize that because that is something that is right there in the region. Let's go ahead and screen vet and ensure that those that are attempting to come in, especially if they're Haitian, that we vet them there, clear it there to make sure they're not part of the resistance, that we can maybe help them here and give them benefit. But also the Haitians have been, they're going to flee Haiti. They're going to get to Central America. They get into Costa Rica, and they're going to work their way up the pipeline and arrive at the United States and again, be back at our southern border and attempting to come in legally or illegally. I mean, this is, again, kind of the way that the process works. I think we do have to stand strong and support those that are, being persecuted. But at the same time, this is why we go back to the crux of we have to secure a border. We have to have the right policies in place because when there is a crisis in the region where we want to be able to and should be able to help out to the extent possible, we've made it that much more challenging for people to accept and to be able to work through the process because of the 7, 8, 9 million people that have come in just in the last 3 years of this administration. So, it's going to be a challenge. And, one other thing on your that you stated is that every other country around the world
steps up and has no problem securing their border, especially if there's something going on. Boy, when it's the United States, we try to do everything we can but secure that border. And I know it's frustrating for our law enforcement, for our men and women, the Border Patrol, and even the National Guard that's down there supporting. But we see it happen all around the world. But when it comes to the United States, boy, we got to – there's a half the country, or at least half the political spectrum wants to, you know, duck their head in the sand and look the other way.
I mean, we look like a third-world country. Good Lord.
Chris Klum, former
– Paso. You know, El Paso is – the community is set and set up to support lawful flow and,
right,
you know, controlled flow, even if it is illegal. They can do that. What we saw this last week and what we've been seeing over the last few years is just incredible, even for a city like El Paso, which is a very large region at the southern border. It's tough for them to handle, and it's a lot of pressure on the city there. So sorry to cut you off, but that was just an important piece because El Paso's mm-hmm. been on the front line. Border Patrol started 100 years ago in El Paso, so they're very fond of their Border Patrol agents. But, yeah, this administration has made it difficult on everybody.
Mm. Chris Klum, former Yuma, Arizona Sector Border Patrol Chief. Chris, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.